your sporting news, reviews and previews. This is the Sports Desk.
Welcome, welcome back to the Sports Desk, driving you home wherever you are listening around the nation on another glorious Melbourne Monday afternoon. I'm your host, Ethan Rigg. I'm joined by Matilda McDermott and Justin Schwartz in what is a little bit of a depleted Sports Desk panel today. Yeah. We're missing the usual three.
Just us three.
Just us three.
Jack's, just us three.
Jack's chilling not out. Here. Yeah.
Jack, you know, I miss his notes. He's got great notes every time.
You don't miss him, though.
I miss him, oh, yeah. Okay, yeah. And his notes.
Just had to let that be known.
I probably should have said that first.
We're all missing Jack quite a lot. How are you two doing? You doing okay?
Yeah, good.
Yeah.
Good.
Freezing.
It's been a little while, guys. We had a week-long hiatus.
No, I missed you guys.
Missed the both of you too, and it's been a big 2 weeks
sport.
In sport.
Yeah.
There's a lot going on right now, and Matilda, speaking of that, I think you should kick off the news today.
Yeah, this one's for Jack, so if you're listening, this one's for you. He really wanted to mention the Le Mans 24-hour race that happened over the weekend. And Ferrari won back-to-back, which is an absolutely incredible feat. Now, they were 14 seconds behind, in front of Toyota, so it was quite a close race towards the end. They had a four-hour safety car throughout the race, towards the end of the race, because of rain and fog, which, you know, must have been so bad that they couldn't even drive, which meant that it was quite a close race towards the end for the winners. And, there were 9 cars on the leading on the last lap, so it really came down to it was pretty impressive to watch.
That's a really close race for a 24-hour long, basically a marathon, to only be within 14 seconds, especially with the safety car that would have helped bunch everything up.
Yeah.
And that seems to be a theme right now in motorsport, where especially in Europe at this time of year, there's still a lot of fog, there's still a lot of rain, so it's making for some very, very close races. Jack alluded to it in one of the other supercar races as well lately. It's good to see. Do you reckon the same could be happening in Formula One too? There seems to be a lot of safety cars.
Yeah, I mean, Formula One right now is, it's very sparse. Like, it's just, they're all so spaced out. And I think we have to wait until the new regulations come in and every single team have to rebuild their car to fit those new regulations. I think then we'll see closer racing like this.
Yeah, definitely. 100%. Another bit of news as well. In for the Paris 2024 Olympics representing Spain, we've got a good clash of new and old. Rafa Nadal and Alcaraz are the two going.
Dream duo.
Oh, that is the dream duo for Spain. That's massive news. Both of them obviously will be probably looking at a singles gold medal, but I could see them, if they enter the doubles as well, doing really, really well, Matilda.
I think so. I mean, they're both really dominant at the moment. I mean, Nadal, he has an impressive resume if you look at it, and Alcaraz is one of the up-and-comers in tennis, so I think definitely, you know, we have the experience of Nadal, the sort of young and fresh side of Alcaraz, so it definitely will make a great duo, and I think they'll probably sweep, to be honest.
I think they definitely should be the favourites and should be going all the way, because they've got Alcaraz, who is one of the top players in the world, Nadal, who's arguably the greatest tennis player of all time.
Yeah.
Those two seem to have a good respect and obviously a very high level of skill between them. Anyway, enough European news. Let's head across the pond quickly, because it is the NBA Finals. And Justin, you've got some basketball news.
Yeah, we're now 4 games into the 2024 NBA Finals, but we're 4 games in and we haven't actually crowned a new NBA champion yet, but it feels like we're on the brink of it. Boston just 1 game away as they lead the Dallas Mavericks 3-1. However, they did lead 3-0 and Dallas bounced back in a big way, taking it by nearly 40 points on their home court to extend the series back to Boston, Ethan. So it's going to be an interesting one. I think teams all time are 0-156 after being down 3-0. Do you think we'll ever see a team come back from 3-0?
I think we will eventually, with how unpredictable the NBA is becoming. It's a much more level playing field than what it has been the last few seasons, and it's good to see a different group of teams making the NBA Finals almost every year, it feels like right now. Although this year, I don't see it happening. I know the Mavericks have pulled one back, and it was a very, very convincing win. But Boston, in the first three games, looks so well drilled. They're going back to the Garden. I don't see Dallas winning this one too much, Justin.
Yeah, I can't agree anymore. I mean, this big margin makes you think, what changed? But nothing really did. Boston just shot terribly while the Mavericks shot it well. And the Mavericks saw some backdoor play as they've struggled to implement their lob that's worked for them so well throughout this playoffs. Luka's been able to draw the defense on his drive and give it off to Lively and Gafford, who have both been pretty well down low in this postseason. But Boston, I think, have made a change that no other team has really dared to do, and they've put Tatum on the role man, and that's worked wonders. He's athletic, he's long, and he's been able to disrupt those passes, which didn't work for them in Game 4. Dallas really exposed that interior defense. But on the other side of the ball, Boston has shot it well. If you look at the stats for the finals, you'd think they're pretty similar, but that's because Game 4 was such an outlier that now the Mavericks have actually scored more points in the series overall. They're shooting almost at a better percentage, but through the first three games, Boston hit 43 threes and Dallas just hit 22. So there's your difference there. I think the focal point in the media and the thing that's got everyone talking is the play around Luka Doncic, not necessarily offensively, because he's been spectacular on that side. He scored well, maybe not as efficient as we're used to seeing from him, but defensively, he has been shocking. I think this might be the worst defensive performance I've seen from a superstar ever. He routinely blown by, routinely he doesn't jump the passing lane. He's so lazy, and I understand he's expending a lot of energy offensively with how much playmaking responsibility has along with scoring, but he has just failed to miss, and he's missed rotations, he's failed to guard the ball, and that leads to overhelping, which is why Boston is hitting so many threes. Dallas is only averaging 16.5 assists per game. That would be dead last in the regular season for the NBA by quite a large margin. So they're not really getting a lot of ball movement either. Kyrie Irving's coming out of his shell the last two games, but he's still yet to win in Boston. So I think this game really feels like an outlier, Ethan.
I would definitely agree with you. And I'm glad you brought up the three ball, because it is the big difference between the Celtics and the Mavs. It's funny you should bring that up about Luka. I've seen him get a lot of criticism for how he's played in this final series. And I'll be honest with you, Justin, he looks knackered. He looks like a guy who's, with the help of Kyrie Irving, but mainly has dragged this team to the NBA Finals this season. And it looks just a step too far for Dallas. I don't think they're all the way there yet. Whereas Boston, we've mentioned a lot of times, this is the project that they've been building for nearly a decade now, realistically. And it's finally, they're seeing the fruits of that labour. Although they had a massive win in Game 4, like you said, I think it's just an outlier. And in Boston, the Celtics are too strong. They seem to have taken the right risks at the right time, especially with Jason Tatum, their star player. And I just don't see how Dallas find a way of combating that. And I also see the Celtics being too strong tactically and knowing their game so well that they get to switch up. What do you reckon, Justin?
Yeah, you've hit the nail right on the head there. It's interesting that you mentioned Luka. He has been playing with a couple of nagging injuries that he mentioned that he would have been sitting out if this was the regular season, but you can't sit out in the playoffs. Something I wanted to mention is that it is 3-1, and we talked about how Boston has scored more points than the Celtics, but it is closer than people think. The game difference, obviously, they're one game away heading back to home court, so there you've got a big ask for Dallas. But Dallas has outscored Boston 151-105 over the last five quarters, and Luka Doncic, if he didn't have that brain fade meltdown at the end of Game 3, we could be looking at a series that's 2-2 going back to Boston. I mean, to know that he's on five fouls and challenge that Jaylen Brown drive when you're never, ever going to draw a charge in that situation was just, I think the whole world except Luka disagreed with that decision, and it just seemed like he was angry and wanted to get out of the game almost, Ethan.
It definitely was a brainless play, and you can tell it's somebody who's playing in the finals for the first time. I know this Celtics team haven't had a lot of experience in this depth of the playoffs, but for the Mavericks, they feel very fresh and they feel very inexperienced at this stage, mainly because they haven't had as many deep playoff runs as Boston, and that really shows. I think it's a little bit of an immature decision from Luka to try and take that on, and like you said, it cost the Mavericks what could have been a win.
Exactly. And okay, so they're heading back to Boston now in Game 5, do or die again, backs against the wall. And they've played well over the last five quarters. As we said, they stormed back in Game 3 and ultimately fell short. But it's all about the supporting cast. Luka and Kyrie have scored the ball well in most of the games, but they've only got three double-digit scorers this series. I just think the Boston Celtics would be too strong. Maybe they threw this game to win it on their home court. I'm just joking. But yeah, it just seems that we are closer and closer to finally crowning the Celtics as NBA champions, and it seems that they've deserved this all season long.
Definitely. It seems like it's about time for Boston. It's a great start here on the Sports Desk. Do not go anywhere. When we come back after this short break, we'll be talking about Euro 2024. Welcome back to the Sports Desk. And for the first time, let's talk about Euro 2024. And it was the start of the European Championship in Germany, and the hosts got off to the perfect start, battering Scotland by 5-1 in what was a really dominant and very imperious German performance. Julian Nagelsmann fielding his first team at a major tournament, and he got it absolutely spot on, Justin.
Yeah, the Germans were just dominant in this game. Scotland never felt like they were in this from the get-go. It was an early start from Wirtz hitting on a deflection, but onto the post and in. There's just not really much to say here apart from that this was a good old-fashioned thumping. I mean, the XG from Scotland is 0.01.
Oh,
Rüdiger,
my.
Unlucky. So unlucky to deflect that one in off the back of his head. But I think Germany pretty much already through now with this kind of battering.
It was a very dominant performance from Germany, and I love this new-look German side. Those, to me, the standouts. Obviously, Florian Wirtz got the first goal, was electric in the opening half. Jamal Musiala, in my opinion, was the best player on the pitch. Maybe only second to Toni Kroos, who is like a fine wine. It's his farewell tour, and he produced yet another vintage performance. The only time that man misses a pass is when somebody's in the wrong spot. To be perfectly honest with you, he basically played that quarterback role in this new look German system, and he played it perfectly. I don't think there's a guy in world football right now, even someone at the end of their career, who you would want in that situation more than Toni Kroos, and it allowed the freedom of Wirtz and Musiala to get forward, as well as Ilkay Gundogan, who had a great game. A disastrous start for Scotland, not only conceding 5, finished the game with 10 men after a horror challenge on Gundogan, which gave Germany a penalty and the third goal. I've got a question for you as well, Justin. After a rough few tournaments, are Germany back as we know them?
Yeah, I think I wrote down one word on my notes here that I think perfectly describes this German side, and it's fluid. The way Wirtz and Musiala, they just look so natural and make it look... I hate using the word effortless because I think it's a degrading way to describe something, but they make it look so easy out there. Musiala, he's never lost a dribble.
Oh,
he is so good. And you mentioned Kroos, but we haven't even talked about Kai Havertz, the composure to sink a penalty and also grabbed an assist as well. They don't really have... I guess Füllkrug is playing that number 9, but... They don't have... Going into the tournament, there wasn't a clear-cut striker up front that everyone was like, this guy's going to bag goals. And this game proved it. They had 5 different people on the score sheet.
Exactly. And I'm really glad you mentioned Havertz. He led the line. I thought he led the line brilliantly. And with the way that Germany want to play, he enables that fluidity. He allows Wirtz and Musiala to roam into the space that he leaves. He's such an intelligent footballer. We saw that this season at Arsenal. I thought Arteta really got the best out of his game and refined him into a top player. Obviously, the calmness to sink a penalty. He's, I would say, the most clinical of the German forwards. Whenever he's played for the national team, he's always produced and played well. And I think this is a system that just gets the best out of all of them. And even Niklas Füllkrug off the bench scored what can only be described as an absolute rocket, Justin.
110 kilometres an hour, I've heard it clocked in at. No keeper is saving that. And it was just the Germans' day. Opening, away from football, opening day, in a home Euros, the culture around the cities, it's just going to be a really exciting tournament.
It definitely is. And another team who you would probably mark up as one of the favourites for this tournament was Spain. And they also got off to a very imperious and positive start, making light work of what is usually a very tough Croatia team. They beat them 3-0 thanks to Alvaro Morata, Fabian Ruiz, both got on the score sheet early. There was just so much control from La Roja in this side. Again, another team who have a bit of a new look going into this tournament. Another team which has a lot of youth and experience in the mix. And I thought they were just excellent, Justin. They were so good.
It's so interesting to see that Croatia, I guess people have called it the golden era, and compared to Spain, who's implementing a lot of youth, Lamine Yamal is 16. How pinpoint was that assist to put it perfectly in the position for a scoring opportunity? Barca have got an extremely good talent on their hands, but I thought Morata, he always plays well in the Spanish shirt, and how that was so clinical to draw the keeper out and then slot it in the bottom left corner. I was so impressed with that, and they've just shown their quality. It pains me to see that, although Croatia had a good response, I thought. They missed some chances with Kovacic and Brozovic, but their XG was over 2.5, I think, so they responded quickly to those Spanish goals, but they just couldn't convert, and it's going to cost them because 3-0 is a big loss in this group.
I'm glad you mentioned the XG there, because I thought Croatia were very unlucky. I thought, in particular, leading the line, Budimir had a good enough game. He definitely didn't disgrace himself. They just weren't clinical enough, whereas usually those chances would fall for Croatia and they'd be able to put them away. In the first half, they were miles off it, though. That's really what killed them. I thought in the second half they gave a much better showing. But the game was finished. Spain were already in cruise control at that point. Lamine Yamal, though, I'm really glad you mentioned him. What a player he is. He is a seriously good footballer at 16 years old. He shows so much promise. He's got so much excitement. He embodies what this new era of Spain is all about. It's fast, it's fluid, it's free-flowing, but it keeps some remnants of the old. He's able to put in a perfect ball. He's able to keep possession well. He just plays such a beautiful style of football, and I'm so excited to watch him this tournament. But what do you think about Croatia, Justin? It didn't go for them. Is this a warning sign that maybe their knack of doing well at a tournament is wearing off?
Yeah, I think the golden era may be coming to an end, unfortunately. Modric is, how old is he, nearly 40 years old? You've got Kovacic, who's just recently moved clubs and didn't play as much as you'd like at Man City. Brozovic as well. It just really feels like there hasn't been that second wave of talent come through in Croatia, and they're kind of seeing the end of that now, and I think they can celebrate a really good run of tournaments, but this one, especially going down 3-0, -3 in the goal difference against in this group, is going to be tough. They're going to really have to scrape out some results to get out.
I completely agree with you. And you mentioned that it is such a strong group. The other team in this group, Italy, they survived a serious scare. Albania got off to a dream start, scoring the quickest goal in Euro history. But within 10 minutes, the Azzurri were in front thanks to a gorgeous goal from Nicolò Barella. That was a lovely finish. And that was good enough. Italy seemed very calm, having been caught out pretty early on. And it had the feeling of one of those days for Italy where they've had in World Cup qualifying against especially North Macedonia. That was the one that really stuck out for me, where they come up against a side who they should deal with comfortably, and they get rocked early on in the game and never seem to recover. This shows a really good amount of mental maturity in this Italian team. Obviously, they've lost a few of the winners and a few of the mainstays from the last tournament, but the defending champs look like they're primed for another deep run, don't they, Justin?
Yeah, you took the words right out of my mouth with the response and the composure. I've got three things here. So the response, they managed to respond going down 1-0 earlier, a terrible mistake on a throw-in at the back. But the first goal from Italy by Bastoni, I thought that was really poor defence from Albania. The free header in the box, it was just, there was no one marking him, and that you can't allow that with such a quality side and a quality player in Bastoni. But Barella as well, I thought the keeper maybe could have done a little bit better there. He was very flat-footed. It's a great shot. He absolutely slotted it. It was clinical, but he was flat-footed and didn't really move, just kind of watched it go in. And finally, the last thing I wanted to talk about was Chiesa. He loves it. He loves putting on an Italian shirt. He has been brilliant, especially at the last Euro. He was almost a viral, I don't want to say meme, but he was a sensation all over TikTok, Instagram. He had a whole kind of cult following throughout that. And once again, he was clinical. He didn't get on the score sheet, but his dribbling and his offensive pressure in the box was a sight to see.
I feel really happy for Federico Chiesa. He's had a horrible time of it with a lot of injuries at Juventus since he's got there. An incredibly talented player, and we saw that at the last Euros, where I thought at times he was single-handedly willing Italy to that final. He's an excellent footballer, and like you said, there's some players who just seem to have it with them whenever they pull on an international shirt. He's definitely one of them. He has so much quality about his game, and I'm glad you also mentioned the defending on the Bastoni goal. With the group as stacked as it is, this was Albania's chance to really land a big blow early on. When you have all the momentum of scoring in the first minute to then go and almost gift a goal back to Italy and get the game back on terms in that way, it's just at this level a little bit unforgivable, isn't it, Justin?
Yeah, it's really going to cost them because, this, like you said, this is their chance. Italy have proven to get complacent against teams that are lower ranked than them, and they put them to the sword early, but it's just such a shame that they let something like that go after such, I don't even know what the word is, how fun it was to see them go ahead. And the celebrations, you mentioned off air, the spaghetti, the snapping the spaghetti. It was absolute limbs in the stadium for the Albanians. And just to see it go away, it's such a preventable thing.
Yeah, it's really, you expect it to happen, but it is a little bit heartbreaking to see. Another team who started strongly and then faded away was Poland. They were beaten 2-1 by the Netherlands in a really, really good comeback from Ronald Koeman's side. Matilda's happy. The Dutch went 1-0 down off a corner. Some pretty terrible marking allowed Buschka to score. He was in for the injured Robert Lewandowski, and I thought he led the line in his place brilliantly. He gave Van Dijk and De Vrij a real headache. But there was way too much quality about that Dutch team. Cody Gakpo got the equaliser. He was easily their most lively player in the first half, where you could tell, although they're in control, a lot of the Dutch players, especially Veerman and Reinders in the middle of the park, were still trying to find their feet. But the composure from Gakpo, and then from late on, Matilda, who bagged the winner for the Oranje.
Wout Weghorst, off the bench, came on and sealed the winner.
He is a Dutch super sub, Weghorst. He did this at the World Cup against Argentina. They were 2-0 down, came off the bench and scored twice in stoppage time to send the game to extra time and then pens. Of course, it wasn't successful for the Netherlands. But he has a knack for doing this in an orange shirt, and it was exactly... He can deliver.
Yep.
And it was exactly what Ronald Koeman's side needed after what I thought was a good enough first display, Justin. It didn't really blow Poland out of the water, but 2-1 wasn't a fair scoreline. I thought the Netherlands were a lot better than that showed.
I also think Poland deserved a point here. They played really well. I'm not sure if Lewandowski was named in the squad, but I think the rumour is that they will have him back in their next game. But they played well, especially going up early. That was a nice sight to see. But something that I wanted to talk about quickly is the Netherlands have a quality defence, but it's not just that. They have great size. I think Ake is the only one under 6'2" in that back four. And to leave Bookshell wide open for a header, he's beaten that tall defence, which is an interesting point. And you mentioned Van Dijk as well, that they were really pressing in that early stages of the game. But Gakpo, he was quality. It's interesting to see him play like that on the left, where Liverpool haven't really put him, and he has cooked. He had one pushed away very early, and then a deflected one went in, obviously. A couple more shots. I think he had 5 for himself, which is really exciting to see. He loves a big tournament, Gakpo, but it's so refreshing to see him played in a position that he thrives in.
Similar to Chiesa, he's another one. When he pulls on the national team shirt, something seems to go through him. We haven't seen the best of him at Liverpool, I don't think, yet. But when he puts on a Netherlands shirt, especially on the left, he's so comfortable in that system. He looked the real deal. He looked like the player that the Reds signed. And his link-up with Memphis Depay was one of my favourite things to see. And he was unlucky not to get on the score sheet himself. The attack's very lively, and I'm sure the midfield will find the right balance. They are missing Frankie de Jong, who's out with injury. That is a gutting loss, because he's a brilliant footballer. He is so, so good. And I would have picked him as one to set this tournament alight. But I want to mention Weghorst. And I also want to mention Füllkrug from Germany as well. What we're seeing is the resurgence of the number nine. Like the big man target, hold it up centre forward. There's a lot of them at this tournament. Füllkrug, Weghorst. There's Giroud with France. Harry Kane for England, obviously. And I guess to a point, Buschka and Lewandowski for Poland. It's so good to see this, I guess, more traditional style of number nine coming back. When I thought it was a dying art, to be honest with you, Justin. And Hungary have got a guy who has got a lot of nice touches for a big man. It's so, so good to see. But what do you make of the number nine resurgence?
I love it. The physicality is something that I think the game has missed a little bit, where it may be more entertaining to see the people that use the pace, your Vinny's, your Mbappe's, who aren't as physical, but they have that blistering pace and they outsmart defenders. But the physicality from players like Weghorst and Füllkrug, I love it. Kane he's another really good example of someone that's not quick at all, but they're just clinical and they're clinical, but and they get into the right positions, and it's awesome to see. I think a good way to describe him is the super sub. We saw it at the World Cup. He's delivered once again for the Netherlands, and he's a Dutch fairy tale at this point.
He definitely is. And speaking of Harry Kane, it was his three Lions that got 3 points in the late kickoff Germany, early kickoff here this Monday morning, as England beat Serbia by a single Jude Bellingham goal to nil in what was a real game of two halves. I thought in the first 45 minutes, the three Lions were easily the better side. Bukayo Saka in particular looks so dangerous down the right-hand side, and the inclusion to start Trent Alexander-Arnold in midfield looked like a masterstroke from Gareth Southgate. A lot of play down England's right was where all of the positivity came, and Bellingham, we've seen it all season for Real Madrid, those late runs, getting on the end of it, always seems to score the crucial goal, right place, right time. He's a phenomenal footballer, Justin. He's just so, so good, isn't he?
Yeah, this England team is stacked with talent. I think something that is interesting with them is they have so much attacking force in this side. Harry Kane up front, Foden on the left, Saka on the right. Bellingham can come into that attacking role. But you've also got Kobbie Mainoo on the bench. So they have Cole Palmer as well, I didn't even mention. He didn't
get on.
Yeah, exactly. And maybe that's too attacking. That's probably why he didn't get on. But with that being said, they also have Declan Rice, who's probably the best number 10 in the world at the moment. Maybe you can argue Toni Kroos, but we'll see. Anyway, that's not the point. Declan Rice is just the man in the middle and the facilitator, and he dictates what goes on in that English offense and defense. And to have Trent step into a midfield role that we're not really used to was refreshing, and I like how Southgate's changing things.
I really like the way that Trent was used in midfield today. I think a lot of his criticism about his defensive game comes from the fact that at Liverpool, he starts so high, whereas for England, he's got Kyle Walker there. He doesn't need to worry as much about being caught out of position, and he's in a system that actually gets the best out of his defensive game. And I'm glad you mentioned Declan Rice, because those two in the middle of the park for England this morning, especially in the first half, were brilliant. They were so good at cutting out everything that Serbia tried to play through, and they've got quality as well. Sergej Milinkovic-Savic, he is a baller. But I thought England's, their midfield pairing, it worked well, and Trent made a lot of crucial interceptions and always actually seemed to be in the right place to win the ball back, which is a big part of why I think Southgate's gone with him in midfield. He understands he likes to start high. Obviously, he's got the best passing range in the side. That's no secret. But I thought it was a really, really clever decision to bring him into that midfield three. And I thought it was vindicated. He had an excellent game. And Declan Rice, wow. He has just continued the form he showed with Arsenal. He was amazing. Just somebody who's able to break up the play. But it's a lot more than that. He's not a one-dimensional defensive-minded midfielder. He's a bit more box-to-box nowadays. And he was able to take players on and bring England up the pitch, show so much calmness in possession. And I thought for the first half they did really well. The second half, England lacked a bit of tempo. And I think this is where a lot of the criticism for them has come in from this game, Justin. But it felt like a game of two halves, and do you think maybe Serbia could have got something?
Yeah, Serbia have, up front, I love Vlahovic and Mitrovic. Mitrovic has been so good in the Saudi League. I think his team ended up winning it, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah, and they, on a mistake at the back, he was so quick to scoring in that first half when Serbia didn't have much built up, and that shows you how lethal they can be up front. You mentioned Milinkovic-Savic. One quickly before we move on, why do you think the partnership of Kane and Foden didn't really work and it looked a little bit clunky?
I think it's because a lot of the play went down the right-hand side. England's obviously are strongest down that right flank. They've got Saka, Walker and Trent in that, I guess, triangle there at the moment. And you've got three players who have got a lot of pace. Saka's tricky. Trent's great on the ball. Walker is so sound both in transition. So it's not risk-free football, but it's a much more controlled way of attacking for England. And I just think they missed the chance to get Foden and Kane into the game more. I mean, Kane did get a chance late on, which was saved brilliantly onto the bar, which would have made it 2-0. But I think that's why. I think England are a right-sided dominant team. I don't think it's too much of a cause for concern. Foden has been a bit quiet, but I'll be honest, we've read this script before with England so many times. They have a first game where they win 1-0 and it's comfy enough. Keep a clean sheet. It's not the most spectacular performance, but I think it's just a very relaxed way to edge into this tournament for Gareth Southgate's side. They did what they needed to do. It was a bit boring, but at the same time, I don't mind that. There's better to come from this England team, and I think they're just getting started, Justin.
3 points are 3 points. You can't complain. And they're a little bit conservative, but it doesn't really matter. As long as you get the win in this stage of the tournament, it's not going to be too costly for them. I still think going forward they're going to be one of the best teams and are still a team to beat.
I agree with you, and I think in their group as well, we want to move on to the last game. Denmark and Slovenia drew 1-1. It looks a very favourable group for England, but moving on, Christian Eriksen scored early after what happened at the last Euros with him. It was a really, really beautiful thing to see him get the first goal for Denmark at the tournament. You could see how much it meant not only to the team but to him as a player as well. He's so respected and loved in that group. It's one of my moments of the tournament already so far. It was such a fantastic moment. And what did you make of it, Justin?
Oh, it was awesome. To see someone go through so much and work so hard to get back to where they were in this position a couple of years ago, it's really exciting. And it was really nice to see football put on hold for a second there and kind of absorb the moment that was involved in scoring that goal and what it meant to him. And I just want to quickly touch on Šeško for Slovenia. I can see why big clubs are after him. He was class. Composed on the ball, played in some good areas, and I think he could be a really nice addition to some clubs that are rumoured to be asking for his services.
Oh, definitely. He led the line so well. Unlucky not to score this morning. I thought he was absolutely amazing. And like all good broadcasters do, the tournament has already started, so naturally, now that we're a few games in, let's lay down some predictions. We'll start with you, Justin. Who is going all the way?
Deutschland! Germany! It's Germany. We talked about them before, we raved about them. How good did they look? Maybe Scotland are a bit on the poor side, but Germany, I can't not pick them. They just have too much class, and how exciting this roster is and this lineup is. The midfield, everything has me buzzing about them.
I could not agree more. I think Germany are one of the favourites to win the whole thing. And every tournament has one. So we've got a favourite. We now have the dark horse, a team that overachieves, goes further than a lot of people would think is possible for them, really overperforms. And who have you got?
I've got Belgium. I'm big on attacking this. I think this is a tournament. The last Euro had some ridiculous amount of goals scored, and I think this Belgium team can produce that. They are really lacking at the back. There's no denying that. But when you have De Bruyne, Thorgan Hazard as well, but mainly Lukaku is my focus. He has the potential to win the Golden Boot of this tournament, but at the same time, sometimes he plays against you. We've saw that at the World Cup and for Inter Milan in that Champions League final, but he's so strong, so physical, and with De Bruyne playing passes to him, I think this team will be a scoring machine. Courtois in goal is a big plus as well, but I think they're a dark horse.
I think Belgium are quite slept on as well this tournament because of how badly they underperformed at the World Cup. I think people think they've missed their window. I wouldn't be too quick to write them off. Lukaku and De Bruyne are a great pairing. They've also got Luis Openda as well. They have some serious, serious talent.
I forgot Doku as well.
Oh yeah, Jeremy Doku. Oh my goodness. That Belgium team is definitely still incredibly stacked with quality and talent. And who's your early shout for the player of the tournament? Who's going to stand above all else and really put on a show?
I said the word before, I'm going to say it again. Fluid, it's Musiala. I don't need to talk about him anymore. No. He has been brilliant in that first game, and I think he's going to continue it.
He's football on cruise control right now. He's absolutely ridiculous. He really makes that game look so, so effortless. And he's a young guy too. Are you going to double him up for the young player?
I wanted to. I mean, it would be the obvious choice, but no, I've gone Xavi Simons from the Netherlands. I love him on the wing, and maybe he goes back to the midfield, but he just has so much creativity on that side, and they looked great. So if they have a deep run, I can certainly see it.
Great, great shout. I love Xavi Simons as a player, and I'm really glad that, despite the fact he's still so young and has been so known about in football circles for years, he is getting the chance to shine on the international stage for the Netherlands and realise that potential. And with every dark horse, there's the other side. There's the shock horror of the tournament. There's the team that crashes out early. Who's going to disappoint this summer?
I've got the defending Euro champions, Italy. A lot of people question their squad going into this, and maybe there's a little bit of truth in that. They showed a little bit of class in that first game, but I think they will get out of the group, but I just don't know if they have enough to compete with the top dogs this tournament.
I agree with you on that. I'm also not too certain about Italy. I think they should get out of that group, whether it's second or third, but I can't see them having a repeat of 2020. Matilda,
yes.
Moving on to you. Who do you think is going all the way at the Euros?
I think it's going to be Germany. I think it'd be great for
them.
Good
shout. Good shout
for two.
Yeah. I've got a very surface-level knowledge, but I think Germany will go all the way. They've got their home crowd behind them at almost every game, you know, and it'll be historic for them if they can do it. And they've got a strong side, so I think they can go all the way.
Definitely would. They've not won the Euros for a long time, and a nation with such a rich footballing history, it would be good to see them back at the top. Who's your dark horse? Who's going to surprise us?
The Dutch. Listen, I'm just backing up the Dutchies just because I'm Dutch. So, like, you know, they're going to be the dark horse. They're going to, I think, surprise us. You know, they sort of backed us, did you say the sixth favourite or something like that? But
yeah.
I think they're going to overachieve and hopefully get pretty far in the tournament.
I like the Netherlands as this shout, because they're good enough that they can go far, but I don't think a lot of people are picking them to. They have enough talent, and I genuinely think they are a shot at least the semi-finals. Although, they are a team who never really seem to win any tournaments that they go to. They did win the Euros in 1988, but it's been a tale of heartbreak mainly for the Netherlands, so hopefully this new generation can change that. You've got the Germans and the Dutch doing well.
Yeah.
Who is going to be your standout player at the tournament?
Listen, I'm going to be honest. Yeah, I just looked at the teams and I was like, you know what? I'm picking Spain. not sure why, but I just get a vibe that they're going to crash out. So
that's a massive call. I would have thought Spain is one of the favourites.
Yep.
But I can also see it.
It'd be a shock if they do.
We don't have a chicken in here, so.
No, I can see it. Like, they were stunned at the last World Cup by Morocco and by Russia in 2018. They also bowed out of the last Euros early. I can see La Roja continuing.
Yeah, it'd be a real shock, you know? You're going for the shock factor.
Definitely. Definitely. Whereas for me, I've played it kind of safe. I've gone the French as the winners. I think Didier.
Really?
I think Didier Deschamps.
You're not going behind your own country?
I'd almost chicken you for that.
I'm going to look so silly if I say England and we go out in like the quarters or something.
You're also going to look silly if they win it.
It's coming home.
It is coming home. Football 100% is coming
home.
What
if they win it? You're going to look like a fool.
That's a risk I'm willing to take.
Yeah, fair enough.
I'm going to go with France, though. I think Deschamps has got a good mix. They've got so much talent. They've got arguably the best player in the world at the moment in Kylian Mbappe. Our dark horses, I'm going to go with Austria. I think they have a great system under Ranić, and I think that they're going to go very far. Young player at this tournament, you went for Musiala. I'm going to go for his German teammate, Florian Wirtz. I loved him in the opening game. And our shock horror is Portugal. I'm not confident about Roberto Martinez. They have a star-studded team. They never deliver. I don't see that changing, and don't go anywhere. When we come back, we are going to have an F1 talk followed by our Minute Mondays all around Dustin Martin. That's coming up. Let's talk about it, guys. Let's talk about some F1.
And it's lights out and away we go!
Matilda, take it away.
So, the last weekend we had the Canadian Grand Prix, and can we all guess who won?
Max Verstappen.
Yay!
Let's go.
You got it, you got it.
I know F1.
Listen, it was a bit disappointing for Ferrari. They both bowed out after an incredible weekend the weekend before. You were sad about that?
Touchy subject.
Yeah, yeah. But because of some... I know it was last week, we had a week off, but I got sort of a question to ask you, Ethan. Yuki Tsunoda announced... It was an announcement that he has a contract extension with Visa Cash App Red Bull. What about Ricardo? He hasn't announced anything yet, and Perez has got the Red Bull C. You know, where's he going to go? Is he going to stay, or is he going to retire? There's a big question mark over Ricardo's future.
I think with Daniel Ricciardo, it really depends how it goes until the break. He scored points at the weekend, finally.
He qualified fifth.
I thought he did really, really well on that track. It was not easy to race in those conditions at all. It went from really wet to really dry. And I thought Daniel Ricciardo managed the race really well. But with Yuki Tsunoda, that extension, I have a sneaky feeling that if Perez doesn't start well next season... they might do a switch. Red Bull are ruthless. We know this. They've done it so many times. They did it to Pierre Gasly. And I can just see it happening that if Perez doesn't start strongly, they will seriously consider Yuki Tsunoda. I think he's had a good season.
Yeah.
And I can only see him improving a lot further, Matilda. But with Daniel Ricciardo, it's a really interesting one. Do they leave that seat for Liam Lawson to finally come in full-time?
That is true.
Or does Danny impress enough to keep it? If not, he could go somewhere else. There's open seats at Williams still, at Alpine, a couple other teams.
Yeah.
Could you see him ending up there?
I honestly don't know. I mean, we know last year he had no interest in getting another seat, nor was there really a seat for him, and he managed to pick it up halfway through the season. So it's just down to whether or not he wants to continue racing, because he seemed really full of energy, really light. But he's had sort of this relationship with racing that is up and down, you know, and we can tell, by the way, he is in press conferences and things like that. So I think it's just a question of whether or not he really wants to continue racing, because if he does, I think he can get a seat. But if he doesn't, then I think he'll retire.
Definitely. I think it's the next few races are really make or break for him with VCarb, and I don't know if I could see him retiring. I could see him making one more move on a 1 or 2 year deal, and if it doesn't work out, that's it.
Yeah.
But I would be really sad if we saw Daniel Ricciardo retire. Only two seasons, really, 18 months after he came back into Formula One. I'd like to see him be given a little bit more time. I know it hasn't really gone his way up until recently. He started to show a bit of that old form.
Yeah.
So hopefully he starts being a bit more consistent and we can see Daniel Ricciardo still in the paddock. The other thing I wanted to talk to you about, Mercedes finally had a good weekend.
They did. George Russell.
George Russell started on pole, finished third. Lewis Hamilton finished fourth.
Yes.
It's
looking up for Mercedes. They've sort of been ghost for the past couple races. Like, they're not really impressing, but they're not also, like, doing too bad that they have to talk about it. I think they've just very much been in the middle. And so this one definitely is looking up for Mercedes. But I think you can tell that Lewis Hamilton is done with the team.
He's very checked out. If you listen to the radio...
He's got his foot out the door.
You listen to the radio, I would not want to be Bono right now. I'm just going to say that. I would be sick to death of it, to be honest with you. Because it's like he knows he's going to leave and he just doesn't care anymore. He's taking no prisoners. And it's so, so funny. The only other thing I really wanted to touch on for F1, McLaren had another very positive weekend. Lando Norris P2, Oscar Piastri in the top five. With Ferrari just having a little bit of a blip, which is very painful for the World Championship after how strong they were at Monaco, could you see McLaren making a run for second in the Constructors?
I think they can. I think if they remain consistent throughout the season, they can definitely do some that. They can get those results. I think Ferrari, very up and down. When they do well, they do really well. When they don't, it is bad. Like, you know, and they just have to really, Ferrari just have to find that consistency within the team and get those results.
Oh, 100%. And I think as well with McLaren, they can rely on Lando Norris consistently being basically on the podium almost every race or in and around the top five. Oscar Piastri is very consistent as well. They are going to give Ferrari a red hot run this time round, and it will be interesting to see how that unfolds when we go to Spain for the next Grand Prix in Barcelona. But for now, let's talk some AFL.
We're going to quickly run through the scores for you right now. So on Friday, we had Brisbane v St Kilda. Brisbane taking the win, 126-106. Saturday, we had Western Bulldogs v Fremantle, 149-82 Western Bulldogs. On Friday as well, we had Richmond v Hawthorn. Richmond 49 to Hawthorn 97.
Good weekend.
Yeah, Adelaide v Sydney. We had Adelaide 67, Sydney 109. Sunday, we had North v Collingwood. Absolute heartbreak for North. 118 to 119 Collingwood.
Sorry, Jerry.
Yeah. GWS v Port Adelaide. Giants 73 to Ports 51. Very sorry for North. I mean, that lost. Yeah.
We don't want to talk about it. It's heartbreaking for any North fan because it looked like they were going to go back to back, and also not the 300th that Dusty would have wanted. He kicked the first goal. The script was there, but the Hawks.
The script was there. Yeah,
the Hawks didn't fancy it.
Yeah, I mean, but the fact that all the Tiger Army got around Dusty and filled the G for him was really heartfelt and awesome to see. That, you know, the Tiger fans are still there, even though we haven't had a great season.
Definitely, it's been a poor season for Richmond, but it is good that they could show up for a club legend.